Chapter 2, The Six-Figure Creative. Become a millionaire not for the $1 million, but for what it will make of you to achieve it. Jim Rohn. In his book, Real Artists Don't Starve, author Jeff Goins reminds us that starving for your art is a relatively new myth on the collective consciousness of our world. It was author Henri Murger's collection of stories that playfully romanticized poverty that led us to caution our creative friends to steer clear of making a living with their great work. Goins says that because of this romanticized mythology, quote, many of us take the safe route in life. We keep our passion a hobby and follow a predictable path toward mediocrity. Goins then points to Michelangelo's career as a creative entrepreneur as an example that predates this pervasive myth by about 200 years. Michelangelo was the model for creative entrepreneurship with creative control of his work and a sizable fortune to boot. What happened? How did we as a culture fall so far from the example of creative entrepreneurs like Michelangelo? The Industrial Revolution killed creativity. I don't believe that industrialization killed creativity entirely, but guys like Carnegie, Rockefeller, Ford, and Edison certainly perpetuated a notion that lives on today. They were the titans of industry, some of whom became so by unscrupulously edging out their competition. These creative entrepreneurs were held out as the exception, not the rule. Today, we call industry giants, and celebrities in general, unicorns, as if to say they are the only ones capable of making good money doing what they love. Not so. We just need a perspective shift to reclaim our inheritance from the unicorns of the Industrial Revolution. In his famous TED Talk, Sir Ken Robinson makes the case that education today is in need of an overhaul because it's designed to stifle creativity at a time when it's not just a feel-good, nice-to-have, it's something we need now more than ever. Around the world, says Robinson, there were no public systems of education really before the 19th century. They all came into being to meet the needs of industrialism. Industrialization and mass production were a logical next step in the work world. As such, there was a tremendous need for skilled workers who could function in that industrial system. Indeed, the concepts of leverage and scale are important and valuable ideas even now that we as creatives might use to reach and serve more of our right audience. But like any system, it was inefficient at first, requiring more input, human resources, in an early development and less input, layoffs, once the system was optimized. The next logical step from industrialization was automation. And the mass layoffs in nearly every industry around the world over the past 30 years are indicative of that step. There simply isn't the same need for labor workers because, like it or not, manpower has been replaced with automated efficiencies that are safer and more cost-effective than the human element. It's a case of oversupply and under-demand, which, any titan of industry will tell you, is the fast track to the poorhouse. Our schools are still built to crank out workers, not creators. The education system, asserts Robinson, prioritizes work skills and academic ability, essentially downplaying or downright negating any value from the creative realms. Like mom's admonition when I was in elementary school, it was well-meaning, but off the mark. Robinson explains, quote, you were probably steered benignly away from things at school when you were a kid, things you liked, on the grounds that you would never get a job doing that. Don't do music. You're not going to be a musician. Don't do art. You won't be an artist. Benign advice, now profoundly mistaken. End quote. A recent report from the World Economic Forum indicates that in 2015, creativity was one of the top 10 required skills in the job market. By 2020, creativity will jump to number 3. That's an exponential jump in a short period of time. Our education system isn't evolving quickly enough to match that demand. As Robinson puts it plainly, quote, the whole world is engulfed in a revolution. The consequence is that many highly talented, brilliant, creative people think they're not, because the thing they were good at school wasn't valued or was actually stigmatized. End quote. The six-figure illusion. A few years ago, a well-respected colleague of mine shared a rather vulnerable post on his social media profile. He confessed that, despite being flown around the world to mentor business owners, taking trips to exotic locations, driving fast cars, and the visible trappings of his success, he was broke. Quote, By nearly all outward appearances, my life has appeared one of numerous accomplishments. I wrote a book, it became a bestseller, I started a publishing company and published 10-plus best-selling books. My financial life leaves little to be desired. At 34, I have a negative net worth and have relied on my father for financial support more times than I care to admit. End quote. He was playing the fake it till you make it game in the worst possible way, trying to exude an image built mostly on what I call the six-figure illusion. It might be dating myself to say that I cut my teeth on the World Wide Web, having built one of the first ever e-commerce websites back in the days when online video was a far-off fantasy. Heck, pictures were still a relatively newfangled introduction to the internet back in the 1990s. Nonetheless, being on the interwebs for more than two decades gives me an insider's perspective on the realities of the so-called laptop lifestyle espoused by so many today. The idea is an attractive, albeit dangerous one. You can build a business working from anywhere with nothing more than a laptop and a dream, according to one online business trainer who has grown a multi-million dollar business and amassed millions of fans and followers with her virtual support team in tow. These online entrepreneurs espouse that if they can do it, you can too. A noble idea, but there's a problem. You can't possibly do what they do because you're not seeing the whole picture. Without seeing the whole picture of anyone's situation, accurately reverse engineering their success is an impossibility. What you're witnessing is basically an airbrushing of someone's life, someone you admire and aspire to be like. The danger? It sets an impossibly high standard for you to attempt to attain. And it's gotten worse thanks to social media. Here's an example. You see a picture of someone's shiny new car that they paid for in cash thanks to their awesome business. They tell the story of how they built a nearly seven-figure business in less than a year, and if they did it, you can too. Sounds sexy, right? So you plunk down $2,000 to be in their training program to learn how they built their empire, only to discover the secret to their success is that they maxed out their $20,000 credit card limit on social media ads to grow their business. And they had a relative who's exceptionally good at creating and targeting social media ads. You don't have a credit card with $20,000 available. You don't have a buddy who knows how to create and target ads. You can't duplicate their success. When I started in the online world, you only saw these kinds of flashy photos on sales pages, the web page where a person sold their wares. They were usually accompanied by a lot of text highlighted in yellow with bullet points outlining the benefits of buying their thing. You'd see a picture of a guy leaning up against a flashy Italian sports car holding a wad of cash, I kid you not, telling you how his product would change your life. In today's evolution, you see social media feeds full of images of people's toes with a view of the ocean just beyond, or a group of people at a conference after party with drinks raised high in solidarity like old chums when they'd only met a few days before. These images, taken out of context, give the perception that a person's life is significantly better than it really is, as if they never have a flat tire or dirty dishes in their sink. It's an impossible standard for anyone, but especially a creative who thinks something must be wrong with them if they've been working hard for years without the same kind of credentials to offer to their audience. When my friend, Rachel K. Albers, RKA as I like to call her, relocated to Mexico, she got some lighthearted flack from her family about living as a location-independent entrepreneur. She also realized how she might have inadvertently been contributing to this whitewashed illusion. She said, quote, "I can understand why my family scoffed when I relocated. I can also understand why they might have resented me. If it really were true that I traded hard work for hardly working, that I somehow gamed the system to luxuriate in the sun making pesos in my sleep, then what the heck is wrong with everyone else? Just quit your job and live your dream, man." RKA is one of the hardest working women I know. She runs a six-figure design and branding firm. Rachel's a social activist and a creative entrepreneur to the core, but it didn't stop her from falling prey to the six-figure illusion. She continues, "It felt good to claim the life other people thought I was living. I felt cool. I might have had negative $50 in the bank, but damn it if I wasn't the envy of every nine-to-fiver with a desk job and seasonal depression. So I kept finding my way to the beaches." The lure of the six-figure illusion is obvious. No training or technical know-how required. Travel the world. Work on your own terms as much or as little as you like. The danger is that, for most people, this is simply not a viable reality. Someone's got to wear the hats you can't or won't wear, which means you got to hire it out. And if you're currently a starving artist, that means you're broke, which means you don't qualify for this life of laptop luxury. Too bad. So sad. On one level, this is a harmless way to share our enthusiasm for what we're up to in life and work. But if your ego starts angling like RKA's did, then this is your wake-up call. Anyone that's posted a photo from that awesome work vacation or that selfie with their internet-famous friend at a conference without showing the other realities of their life has been complicit in perpetuating the unattainable illusion. But then, as RKA points out, we have to live with the consequences of our quote-unquote truth. She says, I didn't make money on the beach. I spent money trying to look like I was making money. Once I got back home to my concrete room in the mountains, I'd have to make up for the hard work I didn't do at my beachside office. But Instagram didn't need to know that. That sexy pseudo-reality is true for a hot second, which is what makes us keep doing it, like that elusive gambling win. In that moment, we are living the dream, so what's the harm in posting one more photo? But reality is always there, quietly reminding us that there's work to be done, and hopefully, clients ready to pay us to do that work. RKA says it better than I ever could. Quote, the fantasy of quitting real life and swapping it for sun-soaked work days and margarita-soaked nights is just that, a fantasy. The dream is alive for as long as it takes to snap a selfie, and then you've got sand in your keyboard and the glare on your screen forces you inside. The truth is, for most people, myself included, there is no quitting the reality of needing to pay bills, be productive, wear sunscreen, avoid hangovers, and protect your laptop from sand because your warranty doesn't cover that shit. I checked it. The six-figure imperative. So why then do I endorse the idea of becoming a six-figure creative? Because once you get beyond the ego stroking, a six-figure business means a living wage for you in nearly every part of the world. I swear by the profit-first model, outlined by my friend and colleague Mike Michalowicz in his book by the same name. The book offers a series of simple ratios designed to keep a business profitable at every stage of growth, including startup. Mike says that until a business is earning about $250,000 US, the owner should be paying themselves 50% of the business income. That means if your business takes in $1,000, you get half of that. If your business takes in $100,000, your owner pays 50 grand. If your business income is $250,000, your owner paycheck is a healthy $125,000. Based on those numbers, there are very few places in the world where you couldn't live on $50,000 to $125,000 a year. The upside is that this keeps the math simple. You get half of whatever your business makes to live on. The downside is that if you're just starting out, you'll recognize the need to supplement your income some other way because you've basically got a jobby going on. That's okay though, because this book takes the need for supplemental income into account as we build your growth plan. Growth plans. There are three types of growth plans. If you're moving into something new or planning to move away from your day job, you'll build a transition plan. Once you're off the ground and working to keep things moving in a unified direction, you'll shift to a momentum plan. Then, when things are where you want them to be, you'll focus on a maintenance plan. And yes, that's still a growth plan, because as your market shifts or matures, it will take effort to keep things stable and not shrink backward. The growth just isn't as exponential at this stage. So you'll determine which plan is right for you and build out your business model around the goals that are most important to you. And I hope that a six-figure revenue is one of those goals, although you may not need exactly six figures. So let me introduce you to the six-figure distinction. The six-figure distinction. The distinction is around reality and expectations. Simply put, there's a difference between a six-figure lifestyle, a six-figure income, and a six-figure profit. You need to be clear on the distinction that applies to you. Close your eyes and imagine what a life of ease would look like for you. Imagine the details as much as possible. Where are you? What are you actually doing for work? Are you living debt-free? How are you investing your time each day? Are you living the beach lifestyle that RKA was talking about? Are you living in a penthouse in New York City? Are you in a beautiful but modest three-bedroom home in Palo Alto or a yurt in Middle Tennessee? Document as many of the details as possible, then tally up a ballpark cost to live your life of ease. Chances are good, depending on where you live, you can do most, if not all of that, on an income near or slightly less than six figures. If so, then you're looking at a six-figure lifestyle, where it's less about hitting six figures and more about having the money to live an ease-filled life. On the other hand, if you're living in New York City or San Francisco, your rent alone might be six figures, in which case you'll need at least a six-figure income to keep all the bills paid. Forget about a life of ease. Then again, if you're the one with the modest home in Palo Alto and a mortgage that runs about $50,000 a month, then you'll need to clear a six-figure profit in order to pay for just your home. It's important to make the distinction for yourself about the real financial goal for your life and your business. All too often, creative entrepreneurs get lured by the fantasy of easy money without a realistic view of how much money they'd actually need to live the life they dream of. Give yourself a reality check now so you know what kind of work you need to do in order to achieve your dreams. Hawaiian paradise or Texas desert? A client of mine lived in Hawaii for years and when she married, moved to Texas for her spouse's work. She first came to me determined to get her business to the point where she could move back to her tropical paradise, but she didn't hold an entirely realistic viewpoint of what it would take to achieve that goal. She had a few things right. She knew Hawaii was pricey, she'd lived there for years and knew that she'd need a hefty income to make it possible. She'd probably have to retire her husband too, but her business had been barely scraping by and she needed help to turn it around. When we assessed her creative type, she turned out to be a chaotic creative, which helped me understand the uphill battle we faced in her turnaround. Chaotics have a very clear vision of how they want things to look, but typically underestimate the amount of resources it can take to turn that vision into reality. Further, their expectations for high quality in everything often mean a bigger investment of time, energy, and money than they have available to them. That means being willing to lower their standards for a time in order to match the resources to their vision. As mom liked to say, champagne wishes and Kool-Aid money. Sure enough, her attention was split in multiple directions. She knew all the things she wanted to offer inside her business, but didn't have the manpower or financial resources to hire it out. So she spread her time and energy across multiple activities, and none of them brought the results we were looking for. Things started falling through the cracks, and her marketing wasn't getting done. She was too busy looking at what other people were doing and asking how we could do something like that in her business. Comparisonitis almost brought her business to its knees, and she couldn't see it. She also resisted the assignments I gave her. The dream blazing planning process you'll do later in this book is a powerful way to get crystal clarity on what to do and how to move forward, but she continually resisted doing the work in favor of putting out fires and quote unquote making more money. The irony is that had she done the work, she would have seen the clear path that we eventually decided on at the end of our first year together. You might believe this was lost or wasted time, but I believe it was a valuable lesson for her. When she would complain about a client behavior, we could point back to what she was doing in her own business and how she was unintentionally modeling that for her clients. Sometimes we teach what we most need to learn. Another issue for her was failing to look at her numbers, usually until it was too late. When it came time for her year-end review, she was disheartened to see that her income hadn't gone up at all and was wondering when she could expect to be making six figures. While your business is profitable, it doesn't bring in enough income to pay you a wage commensurate with the lifestyle you want to live, I told her. I know, she said. That's why I hired you. Right, I replied. And to grow your business, we actually had to tear some of it apart and start over, which means going slower. I then showed her how, when she came to me, she had no business model. She knew she made money by working with clients, but she had no consistent way of bringing in new clients. She had no marketing systems. My client was counting on sporadic repeat business and throwing spaghetti on the wall to see what would stick. She was offering free sessions to anyone who would take her up on it and was often wasting her time with people unqualified to work with her. It took us most of the year to get her to stop trying everything, build her confidence in herself as CEO, and focus relentlessly on just a few things. Now she has a consistent monthly base of income and a clear way to grow that income through specific types of marketing outreach. But she, or someone on her team, still has to do that outreach, or her marketing system is basically worthless. When she took an entire month off and didn't send a single email, she faced several months of lower income as she ramped back up. Finally, she got the picture. By not fixing it for her, by not pushing her to do it my way, she got the learning she needed to finally step into the CEO role of her company, something she had been resisting for years. She focused on a single income project to build her audience and her income. It took several months of effort behind the scenes, and after 13 months of working together, she launched an offer to her audience that ultimately doubled her monthly revenue. She now has the means to continue to build on that momentum. Are we there yet? Not only do you need the clarity of how much you want or need to be making, you need a realistic expectation about how long it will take to achieve that goal. There are a lot of factors that go into that calculation, your available resources being just one of them. When I say resources, I mean anything you could invest. Time, energy, effort, money, attention, relationships, support, and focus. In my experience, it takes each person about the same amount of resources to achieve a comparable goal. It's the mix of those resources that make a difference. The more resources available for you to invest, the shorter the time from idea to income. When you're a starving artist burning the candle at both ends, it's comical to assume you'll hit six figures in 6 months like some people claim. Can it be done? Sure. But they are an exception and often have a backstory that gave them an advantage after years of effort, even if they don't realize it. If they can do it, you might be able to do it too, as long as you're realistic about and willing to do what it really takes to grow your business. If you've got a lot of encumbrances on your resources, it's going to take you longer, statistically speaking. If you've got champagne wishes, but all you have are grapes, you've still got other resources you'll need before you'll ever have champagne. But do you really want champagne? Or have you fallen into wanting it because it's an easy shorthand for the good life? Before you go out chasing paper, let's get clear on how you define enoughness. Drafting your enoughness number. Go back and take a closer look at your day of ease. This time, using a critical eye, dig deeper. Is this a typical day for you, or is this a special once-in-a-lifetime kind of day? We're aiming to create a typical day in the life for your dream life. Again, getting as specific as possible, identify everything you're up to during the day, and put a price tag next to all of it. Then tally up the total cost and multiply it out for the year. That's your enoughness number. Here's an example. You wake up early in your antique four-poster king-size bed with 1,300 thread count Egyptian cotton sheets. You hop into your custom shower in the ensuite master bath and get ready to start the day. The bed will run you about $5,000. The sheets, another $200. Your custom-built ensuite shower is another $7,000 for a total of $12,200. Divide that over the course of a couple of years, because hopefully they're built to last, and you're looking at a monthly income need of $508. Add to that a monthly mortgage of $3,000, and you'll need to clear at least $7,000 a month in your business just to sleep and shower, and you haven't had breakfast yet. The good news is that you don't have to hit that number today, because this is what you're growing toward. You can gradually upgrade your life and business until you attain that number. Along the way, you may find, like some of my clients, that it's less about the actual things of the dream you've been holding and more about the life you create for yourself when you can hit that enoughness number. Somewhere between where you are and where you want to be is your interim enoughness number. I call it the interim number because it isn't, by your own definition, enough. The interim number is lower than where you want to be, so on one hand, it feels like settling. On the other hand, it's still probably a stretch to your threshold of belief based on where you are now. Do you need an interim enoughness number? If your enoughness number is more than $5,000 per month from where you are now, you may need an interim number. In my work with creative entrepreneurs in their early growth stages, it's typically too difficult to make the mental and emotional leap for an amount greater than $5,000 per month, especially if you're starting at zero. There's a lot of mental work that has to happen for most creatives to allow themselves to see beyond that first $5,000 per month. Creatives routinely undervalue their work, a byproduct of all those well-meaning friends encouraging you to get a real job to support your habit. They work for free or next to nothing for years because they think that's all they can get. In truth, as you grow your audience of raving fans, you can pretty much name your price for anything you offer. Sure, there's work to get to that point, but when you create a company that has no competitive peer, it becomes easy to name your price. What makes your company so unique? You. It's why sports and entertainment celebrities are so highly paid. There's only one of them. And when they're hot, they're in high demand because you can't get them anywhere else. People want a piece of you, your time, energy, great work, etc. And that has value because they can't get it from anyone but you. Once you hit $5,000 a month, things feel easier, and in a way, things are easier. The work it takes to get from zero to $5,000 has a lot to do with building emotional and financial foundations that will already be in place when you move from $5,000 to $10,000 or more per month. Dr. George Huang, a business coach and founder of freedompreneur.com, sat down to chat with me about this phenomenon. He explained that many times, the mindset is more important than the mechanics when you are just starting out. There are a lot of emotional hurdles you have to overcome to move into higher income brackets. Dr. Huang explains. There's this mindset piece, which I personally and professionally think is the bigger deal. I think the common theme is, I'm not good enough, I'm not worthy, I'm not deserving, I'm a fake. In my head, I know I should be making more money, but in my heart, I'm afraid that people won't pay it and I'll be rejected. I'll be alone and abandoned. Dr. Huang's thoughts confirmed my own experiences with clients, particularly those on the chaotic end of the spectrum. Remember, these types of creatives set incredibly high standards, making it almost impossible for even the best of us to achieve and maintain them without a lot of resources to invest. Time and again, these creatives come to me saying similar things. For example, one client I worked with repeatedly told me how she used to make a lot more money in her business, and she knew she could be making more if she just, quote unquote, owned her value. She knew she was worth more than what she was currently charging. So on the one hand, she intellectually understood that her great work had value and that people should be charging more, but getting her to raise her rates was painful for both of us. Every time I suggested a higher price, she'd push back and cite the current state of her business. If nobody's paying my current rates, why would they pay more? Do you see how this cognitive dissonance prevented her from moving forward in exactly the way she most wanted to grow? Her brain was saying, make more, you're worth it. Her heart was saying, I'm not worthy. Who am I to charge that kind of money? It's a logical fallacy that TV personality Anne McKevitt disproved when I saw her speak at a conference a few years ago. She told us about working in John Frieda's salon as a young woman. Frieda's salon was where all the fabulous people went for fabulous hair. When he decided to launch his own line of hair care products, he priced the product with a standard markup over cost. Nothing sold. He realized his pricing needed to reflect the expectations of his market. Clients weren't coming in for a $300 haircut and a $5 bottle of shampoo. They saw it as an inferior quality product when compared to the investment they were making in their hair. When Frieda substantially raised his prices, his products flew off the shelves. With my client, we decided to try a pricing experiment on a product she was thinking of abandoning. It had been costing her time and money, and it drained her emotionally, so she was ready to call it quits. She had nothing to lose. Instead of abandoning the product, I suggested modifying parts of it and raising the price. She'd be doing less emotional labor and making more money in the process. She had her doubts, but agreed to it. Then we had to price it. Oy. Knowing her issues around pricing, I suggested something in the middle of the market for the type of offering she was presenting. She resisted. I tried to show her the value, but still she persisted that the price was too high. As you've already seen, I'm not one to push a client into something that they have resistance around. I'll make a suggestion and double check for clarity. I'm not a directive coach because that's not coaching, frankly. Sometimes you do a client more harm than good by trying to push them in a direction that they're not comfortable going. Instead, we found a price that did feel reasonable to her. About 80% lower. I pushed back for clarity's sake. Are you sure? Is this going to give you the spaciousness and ease you want if you have a bunch of people buy at this price? Yes, do it, she said. We launched the revised offer with a goal of having 5 or 6 people buy it. Imagine our surprise when nearly 10 times that number jumped on board. Our little experiment worked. She was thrilled with the outcome. Until a month later, when she realized that she probably could have charged the original price I'd suggested and had at least 5 to 10 people buy in. If all 48 had bought at the higher price, she would have had a solid base of recurring monthly revenue that would cover her monthly business expenses. But you don't know until you try. And sometimes you have to learn the hard way. That's entrepreneurship. It's a balance of mindset and mechanics. As Dr. Huang told me, I believe that if you have the mindset, you'll figure out the mechanics. Your interim enoughness number should be dumb. An interim enoughness number is helpful for most creatives starting from scratch. It's about raising your threshold of belief to match the reality you're driving for. It's purely a mindset issue. That's why I regularly encourage my clients to set dumb goals. D-U-M-B. Doable. Understandable. Meaningful. Believable. We'll talk more about dumb goals later, but the idea here is that your enoughness number might not be believable, so we need to find an interim stretch goal that is. Your interim enoughness number won't feel easy, but it won't feel impossible either. It will set you up for success by giving you a stepping stone on the path toward owning your dreams. If you feel comfortable shooting straight ahead into your enoughness number, then go for it. Some people have no problem shifting their sights to a new goal, no matter how far their current reality is from where they want to go. If you're one of those people, fantastic. If not, your interim enoughness number will put you on the right path without causing you panic attacks every morning. Your assignment. Draft your enoughness number and your interim enoughness number if you need one. Celebrate your progress. This is a recurring theme. As I wrote in my book, The Secret Watch, small stepping stones build tall towers.